Okay, so here we are. This is the third lecture on Chapter 12, Chapter 12 on the Financial Collapse of 2000. And I'm going to pick it up here with slide 33. It says, what is an option? An option, a derivative, financial instrument. Now, right away, we may be in trouble. What is a derivative? Anybody know what a derivative is? Well, the word derivative comes from the word derive. So a derivative is a debt instrument that has value because it's derived from something else. Now, let me give you a quick example of what a derivative. Let's say you and I get together and we make a bet that the sun will either shine or it'll rain on May 5th. So I say the sun will shine, and you say it's going to rain, and so we sign this piece of paper, and we bet $1,000. So whoever owns this piece of paper on May 5th is going to receive $1,000. Okay, the winner of the bet, if you say it's going to be a sunshiny day, and it is a sunshiny day, then you receive the $1,000 from the other party. So that piece of paper has a value, I mean, poof, out of thin air, it's got a value of $1,000. Well, what gives that piece of paper a value of $1,000? Well, the $1,000 is derived from the bet that you and I have made. Okay? Now, the derivatives market is the largest market in the world. The derivatives market today is over a $600 trillion market. So you cannot understand modern finance unless you understand derivatives, okay? And a lot of what happened back in 2007 and 8 was a result of derivatives. Now, like most everything else, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with derivatives. What's wrong, however, or at least what can cause economic problems, is when people make highly risky bets, all right? That's true with, you know, about everything we can talk about. So what is an option? A derivative, now you know what a derivative is, a derivative financial instrument that specifies a contract between two parties for a future transaction on an asset at a preference price, or called a strike price. Now, options in the farming industry are very old, but they're centuries old. I mean, they go back thousands of years. The problem in the farming industry is that if you're a farmer and you grow corn, plant corn in the spring, but you're not going to sell your corn until the fall, then you're taking a risk of what the market price is going to be for your corn. I mean, the market price for corn may be high or might be low. So what you do is that you go to somebody and you sell them your corn at a certain price. We call this the strike price. Like you go to somebody and say, I'll sell you my corn for $5 a bushel. So when the fall comes, you harvest your corn, you sell your corn for $5 a bushel. Now, if the market price is higher than $5 a bushel, then you lose. If the market price is lower than $5, you gain. So someone wins and someone loses. But now the point with options, especially in the farming industry, is not so much to make money as it is to put certainty into a world of uncertainty. See, if you're a farmer and you sell your corn at a certain price in the spring, then you know what you're going to get for that corn. It takes the chance away from the equation. And that's the primary reason, like in the farming industry, why farmers engage in options. Now, in the financial world, it's a little different. In the financial world, people engage in options. You know, derivative is a type of an option for simply speculative reasons. What are the two types of options? An option to buy something at a specified price in the future is named a call. An option to sell something at a specific price is named a put. So in the stock market, there are calls and puts. So you can practice this concept when you're buying stock on the stock market. But I'm not going to get into that in detail. What does it mean to short the stock market? You borrow shares from a brokerage house in order to sell them in hopes that you can buy them later at a lower price. You gain when the price declines and lose when the price increases. So say in the stock market, you know, most people, you know, think of stock market as, well, you buy low and you sell high. You buy a share of stock, you wait a while, the price goes up, and you sell it, and you make a profit. But there's another way of making money in the stock market, and that is to short stocks. To short stocks means that you buy it, and if the price goes down, because you're short at the market, if the price goes down, you gain. If the price goes up, you lose. And all this deals with options. See, if you borrow shares from a brokerage house, you borrow shares in order to sell them later in hopes of buying them later at a lower price. You gain when the price declines and lose when the price increases. That's called shorting the market. Now, what is a hedge fund? A private investment fund which may invest in a diverse range of assets and may employ a variety of investment strategies to protect from downturns and maximize market upswings. A hedge fund is a fund that hedges their bets, so to speak. And when like a hedge fund would invest in certain categories or use in certain financial instruments, but then they'll turn around and they'll buy stock in the stock market, but then they'll also short. There's a good example of this when we get to what is called a credit default swap. It will make this more clear. But a hedge fund is a type of investment company that hedges its bets, who bets one way but then also bets another way, and the two will balance one another out and hopefully put some stability in, but would slowly gain over time. See, a derivative instrument, a contract between two parties that specifies conditions under which payments are to be made between the two parties. Okay, I already talked about what a derivative is, or more specifically, a derivative instrument. And the derivatives market is this market where derivatives are bought and sold. Now, before the financial collapse of 2007, the derivatives market was an over-the-counter market. Now, what an over-the-counter market means is that there was no exchange. Now, if you buy stock, you buy stock on an exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange. Now, what is the purpose of an exchange when you buy stock? Anybody know that? Why do we buy stock on an exchange? Anybody know? Well, the purpose of an exchange is to, like if you're a company and you want to sell stock, well, you have to qualify to sell stock in an exchange. Now, one of the agreements here is that you have to divulge all kinds of information, financial information, to the exchange. Now, the purpose of this is that those people who want to buy stock, well, they can compare different companies, because all these companies on the exchange has given the same financial facts. You know, how much, what their profits were, what their debts are, how much they pay the CEOs. I mean, all kinds of information. So by looking at this information, you can make decisions of, you know, if you want to buy a share of stock or if you don't. Okay, it's information. The whole purpose of exchanges is to give information to potential buyers. Now, this is different than what is called an over-the-counter market. With an over-the-counter market, there's a buyer and a seller, but there's no exchange. So with an over-the-counter market, only the buyer and seller are privy to the facts. Now, what you're going to learn, and what you might have read in this chapter, is that what happened back before 2007 is that sometime you had buyers that were not even privy to the facts. I mean, they didn't even know what they were buying. They just kind of took the word of the seller, like Goldman Sachs, and took the seller at his word, but his word wasn't very good. See, what is a futures market? A specific type of derivative involving a bet between two parties on the future price, called the strike price, of some specified standardized product like price of corn 6 months from now. So this is called the futures market. I mean, it's another term, and I'm just trying to throw out terms to you, but the futures market is a market that takes place based on events that's going to take place in the future. So it's called the futures market. And of course, what you're dealing with in the futures market are options. And the future value determined? Derivatives often rely on some complicated mathematical model to determine future value, like the Black-Scholes model. Well, when you're selling financial instruments, and you've got, you know, thousands of people, and you're dealing in literally trillions of dollars, and people are betting on some event in the future, you have to have something to try to ascertain what is going to happen in the future. You have to have something to hang your hat on in order to know what to buy and what to sell and how much to buy and how much to sell and like that. But with these derivative contracts, it was so complicated that what happened is that there were these people called quants. Now, quants were these mathematical geniuses, you know, from Harvard and places like that. And, you know, these guys wore black, you know, thick-rimmed glasses and were not socially too hip. But they were mathematical geniuses. And they would come up with these mathematical formulas that would supposedly determine what the value of a financial instrument would be at some point in the future. So these people, these wizards that came out with these formulas, and the Black-Scholes formula is one of the more popular ones, are called quants. You know, it's in the song that we just heard at the beginning of this lecture, she mentioned quants. Well, that's what a quant is. Okay, what is an example of speculative trading in derivatives market? In 1995, Nick Leeson, a trader for Barings Bank, the oldest investment bank in London, made a poor unauthorized investment in futures contracts, bankrupting the bank. So there's a great movie about Nick Leeson and Barings Bank. This is one of the most profitable, oldest banks in the world. But what Nick Leeson did is that he got involved in this derivatives market, and he made some bad bets, but it's just like a gambler. You know, sometimes what gamblers do is if you're gambling and you lose, well, instead of quitting, you say, well, if I could just, you know, make one good big bet, maybe I can win all my money back. And that's kind of like what Nick Leeson did. He kind of, you know, step by step, he didn't mean to lose a lot of money, of course, and he didn't even mean to do what he did, but he kind of got drawn into it, and one thing led to another, and he had a lot of autonomy. He wasn't, there was no one overlooking him, and he ended up losing. He ended up bankrupting the bank. In fact, he bankrupted the bank to a point that, now here's one of the oldest profitable banks in the world, and it was sold for $1. Imagine that. It was sold for $1 in 1995. It's a great story, and it's a great movie. Now, I just explained to you what an over-the-counter derivatives market is. I get ahead of myself on these slides. Is it possible that even the purchases of derivatives is not privy to the facts? And see, what happened back before 2007 is that companies like Goldman Sachs would sell these derivative contracts to people like, well, whole countries like Iceland, or sell them to retirement funds. You know, a state has a retirement fund, and so they handle, you know, millions of dollars, and so they want to do something with this money to make a return on it, and so they make investments with it. And so what happened back then was that Goldman Sachs would come to, like what happened with Iceland, they came to Iceland and they said, hey, we've got this great deal here, these derivatives, these financial instruments, and I can show you the history. They've gained 30% over, 5 years, the past 5 years, and you can make a killing. And so, maybe the representative from Iceland says, well, great, what is it? And the guy from Goldman, the salesman from Goldman Sachs says, hey, look, I'm busy. Either you want this or you don't. And so, the state or the country says, oh, well, we trust you. You've got a good name. You've shown us the history of this. Yeah, we'll put, $10 million into it. So what happened is that you've got places, or like states or countries even, that were buying these derivative contracts without any real knowledge of what they were buying. And they thought they were buying good financial instruments, but what they ended up buying was sheer junk, which, of course, led to Iceland, went bankrupt. I mean, it's like Barings Bank went bankrupt in England. A whole country went bankrupt. And Iceland was a very prosperous country at that point. And the derivatives market is about a $600 trillion market. And that's the notional value. Now, notional value, the word notional means, well, there's no way to really know what the value is. But based on all these mathematical formulas and based on these bets that were being made and the values of these bets, we can come up with what is called the notional value. It's not the actual value, because no one knows what the actual value is, because no one can predict the future for sure. But it's the best guess that we can make of what the value of this thing is in the present day. And that's called notional value. So we say that the notional value of the derivatives market today is over $600 trillion. Now, what is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC? Authorized to regulate agricultural futures and the derivatives market. So this is a government agency that was given the responsibility to regulate the futures market. And a part of the futures market is the derivatives market. And Brixley Born, back between 1996 and 1999, was the head of the chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Brixley Born. I talked a lot about her in this chapter, but she's one of the few people that really knew what was going on and tried to warn everybody about what was happening, but she was not listened to. See, what did Brixley Born do as head of the CFTC? She lobbied Congress and the president to give her agency oversight over the counter derivatives market. So she wanted more authority and more investigation about this over-the-counter derivatives market, because she was concerned. She had some experience with this from her previous position before she became head of this agency, and she had some idea of the recklessness that was going on, the danger that we were faced with. So she lobbied Congress, was trying to warn everybody, hey, we got a real potential problem here. See, why was she concerned? Dangerous things were happening in the market, like fraud and excessive speculation leading to major failures. So again, the story of the collapse of 2007 wasn't so much in the instruments, but it was in the speculation and fraud, deceit and fraud that existed. That's what led to the collapse. It wasn't what led to the collapse was not the derivatives market. A lot of these practices, like the collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps, all of these things are good ideas. Those weren't the problem. The problem was what was put into these instruments. And, it was the fraud, the deceit, the excessive risk-taking and speculation. That's what caused the collapse. What was the event that brought these excesses to light? In 1996, Procter & Gamble ended up owing $200 billion in the derivatives market and sued their derivatives dealer, Bankers Trust, for fraud, claiming it was not given proper explanation. See, this is what I was talking about with this over-the-counter derivatives market, that, there's no market, first of all. It's over-the-counter market, but there's no exchange, I should say. And normally the buyer and seller would be privy to the facts, but it was very common practice for the buyers not to be privy to the facts. And that's what happens with Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble took, when Bankers Trust came to them to sell them certain derivatives, Procter & Gamble trusted Bankers Trust and felt that they were misled in terms of what they were buying. See, Bankers Trust said, hey, this is great investments here, but in reality, they were not good investments. And so Bankers Trust Procter & Gamble ended up suing Bankers Trust for $200 billion, which they received. But this was just the tip of the iceberg. What was the outcome between Procter & Gamble and Bankers Trust? In 1996, Bankers Trust settled with Procter & Gamble, forgiving most of the debt. Now, notice the date here, 1996. And when did the collapse occur? The collapse occurred in 2007. So here, a lot of people should have known what was happening 10 years prior to the financial collapse, but a lot of people looked the other way, and bad things just got worse, and finally everything imploded. What happened after Brooks Reborn alerted the Treasury, the Fed, and the Security Exchange Commission about her concern? She was relieved of her jurisdiction over the derivatives market. And this is a common story. Whistleblowers, or people who knew what was happening, would sound an alarm, but instead of being rewarded for their diligence, they were fired. These fraudulent practices just continued, despite the fact that a handful of people were sounding alarms about the fact. And Brooks Reborn is a good example of that. She was relieved of her duties, and the next person, of course, that took charge, didn't have her concerns. Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Fed from 1987 to 2006. Again, those dates are important. Alan Greenspan, the collapse happened in 2007. So, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve for those years that where the bubble was building up? It was Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan is a disciple of a person called Ayn Rand, who wrote two famous books, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. But basically, Ayn Rand was very much in favor of the free market, whereby the government ought not be involved, that the market can do everything. And so Greenspan was a disciple of Ayn Rand. And so here we have the chairman of the Federal Reserve who really is opposed to all forms of regulation, and yet he's in charge of the Federal Reserve, which is kind of ironic. So what was Ayn Rand's philosophy? She believed in a strict laissez-faire capitalistic economic system with minimal government where rational self-interest plays a key role. And that was Alan Greenspan's philosophy. And see, when Brooksley Bourne came to Alan Greenspan and others and said, hey, you know, we should look more deeply into this market, this derivatives market, and I think, you know, that, you know, we should regulate, you know, this market. Well, what was the response of Greenspan and others in government? Well, they said, we're against all forms of regulation. You know, we disagree with you. We think, any problems that may exist in the derivatives market can be solved by the free market. Well, where does this idea come from? Well, it comes from Ayn Rand, or at least her philosophy. Now, the book that Ayn Rand wrote, Atlas Shrugged, just very quick, Atlas, you know, in Greek mythology was the person who held up the world on his shoulders. And when Atlas shrugs, well, the world comes tumbling down. And Atlas, in her book, is the entrepreneur. And the point that she makes is that the capitalistic system is built on the backs of entrepreneurs. But entrepreneurs do what they do because, number one, it's profitable, and number two, it's fun. It gives life meaning. You know, why does an entrepreneur want to turn 1 million into 2 and 2 million into 6 and 6 into 12 million? Because money is a scorecard in the game being played. You know, if you end the year with more money than you started, you're winning the game. You know, money isn't to buy things necessarily. It's just a scorecard. And so entrepreneurs use money as a scorecard, and they do what they do because, well, it's fun. But if you regulate the entrepreneur, if you put too many restraints in the entrepreneur, if the game of finance and capitalism is no longer fun, especially if it's no longer profitable, then the entrepreneur simply shrugs his shoulders and says, "Hey, I'll just quit and, you know, go do something else." And if the entrepreneur shrugs his shoulders and goes somewhere else, then, or does something else, then, you know, the system falters. And that was really the point of her book, you know, called Atlas Shrugged. Okay, anyway, to explain that, how did Ayn Rand influence Alan Greenspan? He was her protege and close friend. And what was Alan Greenspan's response? He believed, you see, as others, not just Alan Greenspan, but others in government, believed that the free market could take care of all the problems and that any interference in the market would be harmful. And it was this philosophy, this belief, that led to so many wrongs taking place for 10 or 12 years before the collapse of 2007. Remember that Procter & Gamble, when sued Bankers Trust, that was back in 1996. So a lot of this was evident to a lot of people. But the overriding philosophy was, well, the government can take, you know, should not be involved. This is a, you know, we ought not regulate this. Now, the beginning of the end happened in 1998 when long-term capital, a hedge fund, was highly leveraged in the derivatives market with $1.25 trillion of notional value with only $4 billion capital to back it up. Now, if you've only got $4 billion and you've got bets out there of $1.25 trillion, that is what is called being highly leveraged. Remember the term leverage? In fact, the video that we saw last time talked about, you know, being leveraged, where you borrow money, like you borrow money to buy shares of stock. That's called buying stock on the margin, and that's an example of leverage. So that if you own more shares because you borrowed the money and the price of stock goes up, well, your gains are that much greater. And so this is what a lot of companies were doing in the derivatives market. They were borrowing money and buying huge amounts of, you know, they were betting in the derivatives market, not with their own money, but most of the money they were betting on in the derivatives market was borrowed money. So a big part of the problem that led to the collapse was too much leverage. See, what happened to long-term capital? In 1998, big banks stepped in and took over long-term capital and incurred large losses on its leveraged investments. So long-term capital made huge investments in the derivatives market with borrowed money. A lot of their bets went south. They lost a bunch of money. They went out of business. They went bankrupt. But instead of simply going bankrupt, what happened is that the other banks, the big banks, got together and they said, well, look, you know, if long-term capital goes bankrupt, that's going to be bad for the whole system. You know, that might, you know, come back on us. So let's buy long-term capital. Let's assume their debts. And then, you know, no one is the wiser. In other words, you know, let's hide the fact that long-term capital went bankrupt by simply buying everything and just continuing on like nothing happened. So what is the Commodities Futures Modernization Act of 2000? This act stripped the Commodities Futures Trading Commission of all responsibility over the derivatives market. So by 2000, it got to the point where even the Commodities Futures Trading Commission had no responsibility over the derivatives market. They said, look, you know, this ought to be a free market. We ought not regulate it, ought not interfere with it. And so things just continued on. If you want to talk over there, can you step out in the hall and talk, please? What did the Modernization Act do? It forbids state regulators to interfere with the over-the-counter derivatives market. Okay. What did rent-seeking have to do with the situation? Wall Street firms supplied over $1.7 billion in campaign contributions and $3.4 billion on lobbyists. Now, remember what the term rent-seeking means? Rent-seeking is when corporations, you know, instead of putting money into making a better mousetrap, they put money into Washington, D.C. to encourage legislation that will benefit them. That's called rent seeking, all right? So what happened, now imagine this, between 2000 and 2010, you've got billions of dollars by these Wall Street firms being put into Washington, D.C. for what purpose? For the purpose of keeping government hands off the derivatives market, to encourage politicians not to interfere. I mean, that was the whole point of this rent seeking that took place. What was the Glass-Steagall Act? Now, I can't emphasize how important the Glass-Steagall Act was in 19. You know, the Depression occurred in 1929, 1930, essentially. And by 1932, Congress got together and they said, part of the problem here was that banks accepted people's deposits and then they put those deposits at great risk. So let's change things so that we're going to have two separate types of financial institutions here. We're going to have banks, and then we're going to have what are called investment companies. Now, this is what the Glass-Steagall Act did. And banks, since they're using depositors' money, we're going to regulate them to make sure that they are careful with their depositors' money. But investment banks, since they don't get their deposits from their money from depositors, they get their money from big investors, we're not going to regulate them. So they can do whatever they want. Okay? So what the Glass-Steagall Act is that it divided these two types of investment firms, banks and investment companies. And this existed until the Modernization Act of 2000. Now, what happened is that these investment companies were making huge amounts of money in the derivatives market. But because of the Glass-Steagall Act, banks were not allowed to participate in this market. So what happened is that banks, through rent seeking, convinced the Congress to make null and void the Glass-Steagall Act. That's essentially what the Futures Modernization Act of 2000 did. What it did is said, okay, we're no longer going to have these two types of financial institutions, you know, banks and investment companies, because we're going to allow banks to participate in those markets, in the derivatives market, just as investment companies. Okay, so in essence, what this Modernization Act of 2000 did is that it reverted the rules back to the way things were before 1932. See, what else did the Modernization Act 2000 do? The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation granted the same protection to investment banks as they did to commercial banks. So what this act did is it went one step further. It said not only are we going to allow regular banks to participate in the derivatives market, but we're going to insure these investment banks against loss just the way we insure banks. So, in other words, this Modernization Act of 2000 really melded, you know, any differences that did exist between investment banks and commercial banks. Now, what is a credit default swap? Now we're really getting into something. A credit default swap is a bet on a future event involving a hedge against a possible default for a price. It transfers liability to an investment party from A to party B. Well, in so many words, a credit default swap is like insurance. Okay, now what happened is that you've got these collateralized debt obligations, but a lot of people could not buy from these collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, because by law they could only buy AAA-rated investments. And a lot of these bonds, you know, a lot of these instruments, a lot of these debts that were in this CDO were not AAA. They were, you know, high-risk nature. So here's what happened. These CDOs would go to someone like AIG, which is the world's largest insurance company, and they would buy insurance against a possible default. And this insurance is called a credit default swap. So the way it works is, we are selling $1 million worth of bonds, but we may not get paid. I mean, there's risk involved here. So we're going to come to you, AIG, and we'll give you so much money if you agree that if there is a default, then you will pay us the $1 million. All right? So now, if there is a default, then AIG pays up. But if there's no default, then AIG simply keeps the money. I mean, it's just like insurance. You know, you pay insurance, and, well, if you don't use the money, if you don't need insurance, well, the insurance company keeps the money. But if you need the money, then you get, you know, whatever it is that the agreement was. Well, that's what a credit default swap is. It's kind of like insurance that was sold. And so what happened is that you might have a CDO that's made up of high-risk type debts, but it's insured by AIG, and AIG has a AAA credit rating. Therefore, the CDO is the rating companies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's rated the CDO AAA. I mean, you might have a CDO that is made up of nothing but highly risk mortgages, like, you know, people with, you know, with these Alt-A loans, you know, liar loans, and people with bad credit histories, and, you know, people took out mortgages that had no way that, you know, they would ever, you know, make payments for long. That, I mean, there's almost 100% chance that they would default on the loan. And these CDOs were sometimes made up of this type of high-risk loans. But they were rated AAA because they were insured by companies like AIG, and AIG had a AAA rating. See how that works? Now, part of the problem here was that this market's not regulated. Remember, this is an over-the-counter derivatives market. And because it's not regulated, AIG could sell this insurance willy-nilly. I mean, there was no... AIG didn't have the financial products division of AIG, didn't have the capital to back up the money that they were insuring. I mean, it's just like you selling insurance, but you've got no money to back up the insurance. And that's essentially what happened. AIG was selling these credit default swaps and yet didn't have the nearly enough capital that if they were allowed defaults, and then those companies came up to AIG and said, hey, look, you know, you owe me X amount of dollars. AIG said, hey, I don't have the money. And this is a central reason for the total financial collapse in 2007. Now, again, is the fault the credit default swap? No, the idea of the credit default swap is very good. Insurance is a good idea. The fault was the instruments inside these collateralized debt obligations, that they were of high risk. It's the fraud, it's the deceit, it's the highly speculative nature of what occurred that caused the collapse. See, when did collateralized debt obligations exist? In 1994, young executives from J.P. Morgan Bank had a weekend meeting in Boca Raton, Florida. See, what happened, this is kind of interesting. In 1994, banks wanted the Federal Reserve to lower their reserve requirement. Because the lower the reserve requirement is, then the more banks are free to lend out more money, all right, and of course, make more profits. So what this meeting was about in Boca Raton, Florida, was what can we do to convince the Federal Reserve to lower our reserve requirement? And they came up with the idea of credit default swaps. They came up with the idea of that, okay, we'll buy protection from a third party, and that third party will have deep pockets. And then they went to the Federal Reserve and they said, look, you know, we're buying what this new idea is called credit default swap. But it's kind of like insurance, and we're buying insurance on the money that we're lending out. And so we think that will give us more security, more stability, and we think that you ought to lower our reserve requirement. And the Federal Reserve said, hey, that's a great idea. I'll go along with that. And so it worked. That was the whole point of these credit default swaps from the beginning. Now, later on, when J.P. Morgan was looking into other companies, other banks that were involved in these credit default swaps, they were amazed that these other banks and investment companies were involved in such speculation, because J.P. Morgan, I mean, they were not into highly speculative type investments. So credit default swaps was a good idea if it had worked the way J.P. Morgan had envisioned it to work. But, you know, banks took a good thing and went too wild, used too little restraint, I should say. Now, what is the American International Group, or AIG? An American insurance corporation who in 2008 was the 18th largest public company in the world. And this company went bankrupt. There's a small division of AIG called the Financial Products Division that under Joe Cassano was involved in these derivatives trades, and they were making a huge amount of money for AIG. So AIG said, hey, have at it. I mean, you're making us billions of dollars, so keep at it. But AIG didn't really know what this division of theirs was doing. They didn't realize that they didn't realize the potential danger. But of course, when they did realize it, was too late and caused the whole company to go bankrupt. Okay, credit default swap. I think I've explained this already. What effect did banks' credit default swap have on excess reserves? The Fed lowered reserves. I've already explained that. What is Standard & Poor's and Moody's? Now, we've got trading agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Standard & Poor's one, Moody's is another, that rate companies. And people buy, like, shares of stock based on these ratings. And what happened is that Standard & Poor's, the problem here, and it's still a problem today, who pays Standard & Poor's and Moody's to rate companies? And the answer is the companies themselves. So there's an incentive here for Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and another one is called Fitch, to give favorable marks, you know, favorable reviews, because companies want, you know, the more favorable the review, the easier it is for the company to invest. And so there's an incentive for Standard & Poor's and Moody's to give optimistic, good marks, because that means that they'll sell more ratings and they'll make more money. Still true today. That hasn't changed. There's a lot of things that we're talking about here have not changed. I mean, it's the derivatives market is still, now the derivatives market today is more regulated. There is a they've tried to make an exchange, where when derivatives are bought and sold, it's supposed to be like buying stock on the stock market, but it's the derivatives market is not the same thing, and it's not very conducive to an exchange. What role did these agencies play in the financial collapse of 2007? Because AIG sold credit default swaps to CDOs, and AIG had AAA rating. Okay, the whole CDO was given a AAA rating. Okay, I kind of get ahead of myself on these. Joe Cassano, important player here. He was the head of the financial products division of AIG that got involved in all these credit default swaps. He sold billions of dollars worth of credit default swaps to banks without the assets to back up the insurance. And what is a naked credit default swap? in a naked credit default swap, neither party actually holds the underlying loan. In essence, two non-involved parties make a bet on some future event. See, we carry this one step further. Not only do we have two parties making a bet on some future event, but we have third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties, and ad infinitum, making bets amongst themselves on the original bet. You know, people that have nothing to do with the original bet were making bets on the original bet. And that's called a naked credit default swap. And Joe Cassano was his brainchild, and so not only was he selling credit default swaps, but there was a market for these naked credit default swaps. See, how did Joe Cassano use naked credit default swaps? He sold credit default swaps protection to numerous non-involved banks on the same loan. So he went to other third parties and said, look, I got two people here making a bet. Would you want to make a bet on the same thing? And a lot of them said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. What precipitated the financial bubble in 2000? Fed policies, deregulation mania, excessive leverage. Again, you know, it wasn't the instruments, it wasn't the credit default swaps or the collateralized debt obligations, but it was the speculation. What is an adjustable rate mortgage? The interest rate would increase over time according to a predetermined schedule. So adjustable rate mortgages, you know, is one where you buy a mortgage, and if inflation increases and interest rates increase in the market, then your interest rate will increase. And this is one of the problems that caused the financial collapse, because a lot of people were encouraged to buy mortgages where the interest rate was very low in the early years, in the first year maybe. But then after that, the interest rates increased a whole lot. You know, there's a lot of people who don't look at tomorrow. I mean, they'll look at today and say, hey, look, I can borrow money. I can get into this house. This is my monthly payment. And so that's what I'll do. And, you know, not thinking that what they're buying is an adjustable rate mortgage, that next year interest rates is going to double or triple, and their payments is going to, you know, greatly increase. Well, they don't think that far in the future. They just say, hey, look, you know, I can borrow money today, I can move into this house tomorrow, and I can afford this monthly payment, period. You know, there's a lot of people that don't look at tomorrow. And so this was one of the problems with the financial collapse. A lot of people were buying mortgages because of these adjustable rate mortgages. The interest rate was artificially low in the early years, and of course then increased a lot in the second, third, fourth years. What does it mean to be upside down on a mortgage? Now, the other problem, and I mentioned this before, being upside down on a mortgage means you owe more on the house than what the house is worth in the market. So what happened is a lot of people bought houses with these adjustable rate mortgages. They were paying these low interest rates to begin with, and as the price of the house went up, their equity went up, but then after a certain point, the price of the house started to come down. And so what happened with the people, especially those that got in late, were latecomers into this whole process leading up to 2007, they found themselves upside down in the mortgage. And when you're upside down in the mortgage, you have an incentive simply to walk away. I mean, what else can you do? I mean, you can't afford to make the monthly payments. You can't sell the house, because even if you sell the house, you can't get enough money to pay off the loan, and so you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So why not just chuck the whole thing and throw the keys at the bank and say, hey, look, you know, here's your house, adios. And a lot of people did this. Wow, and that's the end. Well, I did it. Not bad. I really had to rush through that. So any questions about any of this? Well, I hope this makes what allows you to understand, you know, a lot of what's happened, and maybe help you understand what could be coming up. But anyway, this is the end of the course. So y'all have a nice break, and email me, you know, if you have any concerns. So by the way, there are several students. Well, not a whole lot, but some that are finding some errors on these tests. And I said at the beginning of the semester that if you find errors on these tests, I'll give you double points. And just this morning, I had one girl got eight extra points on her test because she found, I mean, I'm trying to find errors on these tests. You know, these tests are not perfect, and I do make mistakes. And if you can find a mistake, then email me. And what I'll do is I'll give you double points, and then I'll go into the test pool and, you know, make the correction in the test pool. So that helps me, you know, make these tests better, and that helps you get extra points. So, you know, when you take a test, you know, look at those questions you missed, and, you know, don't always assume that, you know, you were wrong and I was right. I mean, you could be right and I'm wrong. So anyway, keep that to heart because, it could make a difference for you. Anyway, let's call it a day. Let's call it a semester. And I'll see some of you in the Econ 202. So let's call it a day.
I have one.
Let me take care of this. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going home and I'm going to take those two tests.
Okay.
And I'm going to try to get an 80 on them, like we talked about.
Yeah.
But if I do, and I end up with an A in the course, I appreciate all that.
Yeah, great. I hope you, I'm sure you'll do it.
I'll take 202
yeah.
with my semester next semester.
Yeah.
Probably not the best of ideas.